Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out all the things that 1517 does. We do a lot more things than just this podcast. If you're one of those listeners that's never went to 1517.org to check out what exactly that 1517.org is, you need to go ahead and do that, because what we have over there is daily articles. There's tons of videos. Chad does videos every week. There's conference videos from past conferences we've done. We do conferences every year. There's a bunch of other podcasts. There's all kinds of stuff that you can peruse over at 1517. So make sure that you do that if you haven't done it before. Chad, we're in 1 Kings chapter 15. We ended last week with being introduced to a guy named Asa, and he is comes from his lineage, a little weird. We learned it's a little weird. So his mother and his grandmother are same person.
Yeah.
So that's a little different.
A little odd.
And God says, "Aha! This is exactly the type of dude that I think I could use."
Just like God to do that, for sure. Yeah, this is a sixth, I guess, king that we have in the south. So he begins to reign over Judah when Jeroboam is still king in the north, and we're told that his mother's name was Maakah, the daughter of Abishalom. Of course, this is the same woman who is also his grandmother. And we're kind of picking up here with verse 11. So 1 Kings 15, 11. We're going to find out more about what he did and some of the ways that he used political maneuvering to his advantage, and then the downside of that in these next few verses. So the first thing we're told is that Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David, his father, had done. Of course, David becomes the gold standard against which all the kings in the south are measured. Now, I did not know this until I was researching this. And I think most people who are generally familiar with 1 and 2 Kings know that in the south, after David, then you have really two stellar kings, right? And those are Hezekiah and Josiah. Those are the ones right. that most people will say, yeah, I mean, you had, you know, some bad kings, some mediocre kings, and then you had these two pillars. You had Hezekiah, and then you had Josiah especially. But I realized that actually there are eight kings in the south who were told did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, did what was yashar in the Hebrew, what was proper, what was fitting, what was right in the eyes of the Lord. And Asa is the first of these. The same language basically is used to describe each of these. Asa, and then Jehoshaphat, that's a name that a lot of people are familiar with. And then some of these others are not as familiar, like Jehoash and Amaziah and Azariah and Jotham. And then the last two are Hezekiah and Josiah. So eight kings in all in the south, this is not the north, but in the south, who did what was yashar, who did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. So, yes, I mean, these guys weren't perfect, and we'll see plenty of examples of that beginning here with Asa. But at least, I don't know why they were trying. they were at least not engaging in kind of the rank idolatry that was happening in the north, and that some of their predecessors were engaging in. So Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David his father had done. Well, you might be saying, what does that look like? What did that mean? Well, we're told immediately in verse 12 and following what this consisted of. And it'll come as no surprise if you've been listening to even more than one podcast with us that this is all about idolatry, which is, of course, what Kings is all about. So here's what he did. First of all, he put away those male cult prostitutes out of the land. So we talked about those in the last episode. There's a bit of ambiguity as to exactly what these male cult prostitutes did. I mean, of course, if the translation is correct, we know what they did, but how this looked, how this worked in the ritual system of Israel, we don't know. But anyway, he put them away, and probably by put away, there's more implied to that than kind of the simply generic meaning that. So he probably didn't just fire these guys, let's put it that way. Probably
put them away permanently, huh?
Put them away permanently. Let's leave it at that. Out of the land. And he removed all of the idols that his father had made. Now, you may or may not be aware of this, but when the Hebrew talks about idols, there's a whole number of Hebrew words that are used to describe these idols. And many of these words that are used, even though you can't see it in the English, are very pejorative in connotation. And this is a great example of these. So the ESV translates this as the idols that his father had made. The Hebrew is Gilulim. Gilulim is related to galal, which is the Hebrew word for dung. So, and if you're familiar with Ezekiel, you know that Ezekiel has some pretty racy sexual imagery that he uses to describe the idolatrous proclivities of Israel. He also likes to use this scatological language to describe the false gods, because so Gilulim, the word translated here is idols, that's related to the word for dung, occurs 48 times in the Old Testament. A whopping 39 of those are in Ezekiel's mouth. So Ezekiel loves to call false gods Gilulim. Now, there's a lot of ways that we could, if we were to translate this literally, we have various options. We could call these dung deities, or, crap gods. Or you can just use your imagination. This is a family program for other names that we could use for these. But do keep in mind that the prophets and the historians who are writing 1st, 2nd Kings do not shy away from using extremely pejorative, negative language to depict these false gods that are being worshipped or that are being removed.
And basically, any way you slice this, idols is not a proper translation and is a translation that is trying to make this feel cleaner. A little cleaner than it is.
Yes. One of my probably primary criticisms of some translations. I mean, you don't have to translate it in kind of vulgar language, but there are ways to translate this that brings out more of that pejorative connotation that the word carries.
Well, it's supposed to be. You will see this when we get into Elijah and this sort of stuff, that when it comes to idolatry, that God does use, and the scriptures uses language which would in fact be offensive to the worshipers of those gods on purpose.
Yes. Yeah, it is designed to upset those who are worshiping these gods.
Yes.
So they're not calling them idols.
No.
They're calling them vanities, as we'll see in later in this chapter. Empty, vaporous things, or Gilulim, dung deities, or there's a whole list of negative words that the prophets use to describe these gods. And like you say, that's on purpose. It's meant to admit, it is meant, designed to offend those who are worshiping them. Well, these Gilulim, these dung deities, Asa removed, the ones that his fathers had made. And not only does he revolt theologically, and rightly so, against his father, but also the same thing happens toward his mother / grandmother. In verse 13, we read that he also removed Ma'akah, his mother / grandmother, from being queen mother, because she also made an abominable image for Asherah. Now, that's a little stronger translation of another Hebrew word, Mifletzet. Now, probably a better translation would be something like this horror that she had made. The word is related to these like spasms of horror that someone might endure. So again, they're reaching for any kind of negatively freighted word to describe these idols and these images. So this abominable image or this horror for Asherah that Ma'akah, the mother / grandmother of the queen, had made, he took care of that. He cut it down, so evidently it was some sort of, maybe it was in like the Asherah poles, some sort of wooden image. He cuts it down, and he burned it in the Kidron Valley, there at the brook Kidron. So he's doing everything necessary to make sure that everyone realizes, first of all, that he is opposed to idolatry, and secondly, that he's going to make sure and do something about it, so much so that he burns it. Just like Moses took the golden calf and he burned it down and he put it in the water and he made the people drink it. Same thing same sort of thing is happening here. There's a complete destruction of this idolatry. There's no attempt, in other words, to urge, you know, why don't, let's just kind of live and let live. Let's just all exist, coexist together. You know, you're fine worshiping Yahweh, but if you want to worship Asherah, if you want to worship whatever, that's fine. That's not going over in Israel, not when Asa's king.
You have to wonder if this, you know, this worship of Asherah by his mother slash grandmother is the whole reason that she is his mother slash grandmother. I mean, so pagan worship often resulted in all kinds of weird sexual stuff. And if that's the case, then this sort of idolatry is the very reason for his existence, and he has then turned against it, which is pretty remarkable.
It is pretty remarkable. Yeah, very commendable to him, and no doubt to many of his contemporaries, also very reprehensible to them if they were worshipers of this kind of thing. In other words, he's not taking any hostages, any theological hostages, if you will. He's making sure that all of this stuff is taken down. Just like Gideon was instructed by the Lord's messenger to destroy the altar to Baal that his dad had constructed, and he did. So this new Gideon, if you will, Asa, is doing the same thing. He's taking these things down. But verse 14, it begins with that word, but, and this is actually pretty common for this list of eight kings where you have them doing what was right in the eyes of the Lord and revolting against the idolatry. There'll be an exception. So, but such and such didn't happen, or he didn't remove such and such. And much of the time, it's the high places that are not taken away. It says, but the high places were not taken away. I don't know exactly why. There's various theories here. You know, was it one of these situations where the high places were just kind of scattered all throughout the country, and it was too much effort to try and root out all those? Or were the high places being used mostly for the worship of Yahweh, and so he's like, well, I'll just let them stand? Who knows? It is a criticism. It's a mild criticism, we might say, but it certainly is a criticism of Asa.
Yeah, well, it seems that the high places are harder to take away because they're places. I mean, taking away idols is one thing. You're like, hey, I'm going to chop this pole down and burn it in the brook over here. Okay. Gather up all these idols and get rid of them. Okay. I'm going to take away these high places. Well, the problem with that is that you could take away the thing that they, you know, the stack of rocks or whatever that they put at the high place, but the people are still like, that's the high place. And once the idolatry has seeped in and you've now started thinking that the place is what matters, this is very easy to reinvent over and over again. And so it could be just as simple as the people were still visiting these places as places of worship. And that's a little bit more of a difficult thing to root out. I mean, if they're scattered all over the country, you're like, look, what am I going to do? Like, I'm going to tear down that hill, or I'm going to tear down, like, I'm going to burn that valley up. What am I supposed to do here?
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, yeah, you can bulldoze, as it were, an idol, right? But you can't bulldoze an ideology.
No.
Or theology. That's to root that out is a whole other challenge.
And if they associate that thing with a spot, like, what are you supposed to do? Like, I can't get rid of the spot.
Yeah, right. It's still there. Yeah. Once it's seeped into their mind that, you know, that place is a high place and that place is a high place. Well, yeah, you could clear all the stones out. You could demolish the altar or whatever, but the place is still there. And so what's going to happen? Well, if people want to, they'll just go back, and it's not that difficult to build a stone altar.
No, just stack some rocks up and boom, you're back at it.
Get some wood and you're ready to go. So these things will be, a thorn in Israel's side all throughout their history with these high places. They're scattered here and there. So they're there. But then it's like Asa's praised, okay? Then we have a mild criticism, and then we're going to praise him again. And this next praising is, nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true to the Lord all his days. Now, it is not uncommon for the scriptures to make those sort of blanket statements, and there to be exceptions to that. This is just kind of a general commendation of Asa. He was we might say he was a pretty good king, relatively speaking.
I look at this and I just think about justification via faith. And I just read this as Asa was a believer in Yahweh, that Asa was a king who had faith. Therefore, God is going to make this pronouncement about him, that he was wholly true to the Lord. Because ultimately, as we've said over and over and over again, is Asa out there worshiping other gods? No, he's not. In fact, he's getting rid of other gods. Who is he worshiping? He's worshiping Yahweh. So what is he? Holy faithful to the Lord.
Holy faithful. Yeah.
As far as the scriptures are, and as far as the Old Testament is, not just the Old Testament, and the Bible in general, so what the scriptures convey is believer in Yahweh, man of faith, equals holy, devoted to the Lord. That's what you are. It's real simple that way.
Yeah, that's the saint side of the saint sinner. Right?
It is.
I mean, every Christian can say of himself, "My heart is wholly true to the Lord my God."
Yeah,
and in Christ, that is perfectly true. The saint side of us, that is perfectly true.
Yep.
So as it was for Asa, so it is for us. Now, verse 15 says that he brought into the house of the Lord the sacred gifts of his father and his own sacred gifts, silver and gold, gold mentioned again, and vessels. So this is, a restocking maybe of the temple after we lost all the gold shields to Shishak, the king of Egypt. Now we're replenishing that perhaps, at least some of it. So he brings into the temple these sacred gifts of gold and silver and various kinds of vessels.
More gold available to, you know, make stuff out of when you're not making idols out of it.
Yeah, that's true. maybe they're repurposing some of that gold that was used.
Asa's got the big recycling program going on.
So we're going to hear more about him in the verses that follow here. This is one of these occasions where more is said than simply there was war. We're going to hear that a lot. There was war between Jeroboam and Rehoboam. There was war between this king and that king. Well, often those are just kind of leaving us wondering, well, what did this consist of? What did it look like? Well, we're going to find out at least a few more details about part of that war in verses 16 through following. There was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. Now, we don't know anything about Baasha yet because we have yet to be introduced to him, but we're going to find out more as we proceed. So just hold your hat for that one. We do know there was war between this southern king and this northern kingdom all their days. Here's what Baasha, who's the king of the northern kingdom, did. He went up against Judah and he built Ramah that he might permit no one to go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. So Ramah is, there's actually more than one of these in the scriptures, but this is in Benjamin's territory, and it's north of Jerusalem. It's kind of a place of crossroads, north and south, east and west. And so it was a critical city, and basically seems what's happening here is that the north is coming in under the leadership of Baasha, who's the king of Israel, and they're taking over this city in order that they can control traffic, more or less. So, you know, this is a different kind of world than we live in. We got like 100 roads leading into all of our cities. You don't have that, of course, back then. You got these strategic places that are all determined by geography, where you have different routes from the north or south or east or west to get into cities. So the goal here is for the north to come in to control the city of Ramah, in order to make sure that they have some control over what's going on in Jerusalem and the southern kingdom. So this is a strategic military move on their part to try and have some kind of control over what's going on in the south. So obviously, the northern army have concentrated their efforts here in the south, kind of in the borderlands, we might say, between the northern and southern kingdom. So what's Asa do? Well, Asa takes that silver and gold that we just heard about that were in the treasures of the house of the Lord. So we're just told that he took it into the temple, and now we're told he's going to take it out. He takes the silver and gold that were in the treasure of the temple and in his own palace, and he puts this into the hands of his servants, and he sent his servants with all this gold and silver north of the northern kingdom to a guy by the name of Ben-Hadad. Now, Ben-Hadad was the king of Syria. So if you kind of just picturing in your mind, you got Judah in the south, and then, of course, you have Israel north of there. And then north of Israel was this place called Syria, also known as Aram, depending on your which translation you're using. So they're either it's either translated as the Syrians or the Arameans. Same thing. So Ben-Hadad is the ruler of Syria, and he's living in the place called Damascus, which, of course, comes up even in the book of Acts. We hear more about Damascus in Paul's journeys. And here's what he says. So Asa sends his servants with all this money, with all this silver and gold, to Ben-Hadad, king of Syria. And here's the message they are to deliver, verse 19. Let there be a covenant between me and you, as there was between my father and your father. Behold, I am sending to you a present of silver and gold. So, kind of between the lines here, here's what I want you to do. Go and break your covenant with Baasha, king of Israel. He's like, I know you already have this treaty with him, this covenant, this pact with my adversary in the north, Baasha. So I want you to break that and instead make a covenant with me. And then he's going to withdraw from me. So that's basically the message. Messengers show up with this message. They got all these gifts. And we're told in verse 20 that Ben-Hadad listened to King Asa and sent the commanders of his armies against the cities of Israel in the north. And they conquered all these places, Ijon, Dan, Abel-Beth, Ma'akah, and all Kinneret, with all the land of Naphtali. Now, these places are around the Sea of Galilee. In fact, that name, Kinneret, it sometimes appears as Kinnereth, and that comes into Greek as Gennesaret. So, in fact, I looked today, and Luke 5 actually he calls the Sea of Galilee. I think it's the only place in the Gospels. He calls the Sea of Galilee the Lake of Gennesaret. And in that way, he's actually echoing what the Old Testament calls it. The Old Testament often refers to the Sea of Galilee as the Sea of Kinneret or Kinneret. And so anyway, Luke is duplicating that here. But all these places are around the Sea of Galilee. So what's going to happen? So Ben-Hadad takes his armies. They are attacking the northern part of Israel while the Israelite army is in the south, building up Ramah in order to cut off traffic to Judah. So the southern army realizes they're in trouble. So now they have to withdraw from the south. They have to leave Ramah, and they have to go and defend their territories in the north up by the Sea of Galilee. So this works out perfectly for what Asa is wanting to happen. So King Asa then makes this proclamation saying that here's what I want everybody to do. Come with me to Ramah, and we're going to take all the stones and the timber from Ramah, where Baasha had been building these fortifications, and we're going to use them to build these other two cities, which are even farther north from there, these two places called Geba and Mizpah. So more or less, what the southern king had been trying to do in Ramah in order to make it hard for the southern king, what the northern king was trying to do to make it hard for the southern king is now going to turn around and make it hard for the northern king. He's going to make these fortifications north of Ramah. So that shows, first of all, the kind of the political maneuvering that's taking place. And it shows the struggle between north and south. And if you were to read the chronicler's version of this, it also shows that Asa, even though he was wholly devoted to the Lord as God and not practicing idolatry, was rebuked by a prophet for basically turning to the Gentiles for help instead of turning to the Lord for his assistance. So it's kind of that rebuke is not recorded in Kings, it is recorded in Chronicles. And it's an illustration of kind of the politicking that was going on and the political maneuvering that was going on in order to make sure they had some kind of control over what's happening militarily.
Yeah, it's sort of a bummer, right? That you put away the idolatry and stuff, and this doesn't foster like some kind of bringing the kingdoms back together, or at least like figuring out how to work together, being brothers as opposed to enemies, and it just doesn't work that way. Instead, he does all this stuff, but he still finds himself in conflict.
Yeah, it is one of those where I mean, we're dealing with a guy who did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and he was wholly devoted to Yahweh. But that doesn't mean that all of a sudden he's perfect.
Right.
it means he's still a sinner who does sinful things. And it just so happens that because he's a king, a lot of those sinful things that he is going to do are national in scope. And this is one of those cases where he turns to the Gentiles, basically says, hey, break off your treaty with this guy in the north who's causing me such problems, and I'll give you all this money. And the guy's like, Benadad's like, well, sounds good to me. Hey, you bring all the silver and gold, I'm more than willing to do that. So it works. I mean, it does work for sure.
And it's not as though Asa initiated this particular conflict. I mean, he is responding to something that is being done to him.
True. Yeah, he didn't decide, you know what, we're just going to get some stones and timber, and we're going to fortify these cities against the north. Now, it is a defensive tactic of his. But at the same time, there is this there's the rebuke that is issued by a prophet where he turns basically to the Gentiles for help instead of to the Lord.
Yeah, he does do this thing. I mean, it's always like, you know, it's not like the most awesome thing when you go up to someone and be like, hey, what do I need to give you to make you break covenant with this person? It's not the best.
Not the best. Yeah. I know you have an agreement and all, but if I pay you more money, would you break that agreement? And Benadad, who's, you know, a typical opportunist, he's like, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're giving me a whole lot more money than he gave me. So I can be bought off.
Yeah, sure. I'll go fight some dudes over here. It's fine.
Yeah, I'll be your mercenary king for you if you want me to. Because, you know, of course, it was all in Benadad's to his advantage. Not only does he get paid for this, but he attacks all these cities, towns, villages around the Sea of Galilee. Again, no doubt, for some monetary benefits.
Yep.
So it's great for him. Now, picking up with verse 23 and wrapping up what we know about Asa. Now, the rest of all the acts of Asa, all his might and all he did, and the cities that he built, are they not written? Any guesses? Any guesses to where they might be written?
I'm guessing it's in the Chronicles of Kings of Judah.
There you go. You're right. Yeah, A plus. But in his old age, he was diseased in his feet, we're told. Kind of a random detail about his life. Again, I don't want to go to Chronicles all the time here. But the chronicler adds that this detail about his foot problems. And it also says he turned to the physicians, but not to the Lord. So another one of those, you know, like somewhat mild criticisms of him. He was relying entirely upon the physicians. And for whatever reason, as he got older, he was not relying as much on the Lord. And we're told, verse 24, in typical king's language, that he slept with his fathers, was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father, and his son, Jehoshaphat, reigned in his place. But we're going to have to wait a little bit to find out about this Jehoshaphat, because in this dance we have between north and south, we're going to switch. We've been dancing in the south, and now we're going to dance in the north. So we're going to go all the way back. We've heard, you know, about several of these southern kings that they began to reign in the 5th or the 10th or the 15th or whatever the year was of Jeroboam. But what about Jeroboam's son? Well, now we're going to hear more about him. Verse 25, Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, began to reign over Israel in the second year of Asa, king of Judah. And he reigned over Israel for 2 years. So, very short reign. No surprise, verse 26 tells us that he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of his father, and in his sin, which he made Israel to sin. That's also pretty stereotypical language for the Jeroboamizing of Israel. It all starts with him. He's kind of like, I guess you could call him the Adam figure. It's like Paul will say, as in Adam, all die. So Adam's sin is goes down to his descendants, sort of analogous here. What happens with Jeroboam is that the whole northern kingdom dies, we might say. They're all polluted by what's happening with Jeroboam's sin. So he did, his son did what was evil in his eyes. And verse 27 tells us that Baasha, who's from the tribe of Issachar, that Baasha conspired against him, and he struck him down to this place called Gibbethon, which was a Philistine city, while Nadab and all Israel were laying siege to this Philistine city. So he's barely been a king 2 years. He's the son of Jeroboam. His name is Nadab, and he's leading his armies against this Philistine city, and while they're there, Baasha cuts him down, kills him in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and he reigned in his place. So this is the first of many turnovers. So you don't, the longest dynasty that you have in the north is the dynasty of Omri that we'll meet later in the chapter. What you have for the most part is maybe a guy will have his son reign in his place and he gets taken out, replaced by somebody else. There's a coup, there's a bloodbath, whatever it might be. And this is the first of these occasions. So Baasha comes along, he kills Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, and he reigns in his place. And what did he do? As soon as he became king, he killed all the house of Jeroboam, took everybody out. He left to the house of Jeroboam not one that breathed until he had destroyed it, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by his servant Ahijah the Shilonite. So you may remember we talked about this in 1 Kings 14, that Ahijah the Shilonite said that God was going to cut off from Jeroboam every single male, bond and free in Israel, and that he would burn up the house of Jeroboam. And that's in fulfillment of what was said. So now this is happening. This guy named Baasha comes in. Not only does he kill the king, Jeroboam's son, but he kills all of Jeroboam's descendants. He's going to make sure that there are no survivors who might come back and stab him in the back, basically.
It's interesting how sometimes God will tell you something's going to happen and say, hey, you've corrupted the kingdom. You've turned your back on me. Here's what's going to happen. But it's not going to happen through the angel of the Lord coming down. It's not even going to happen through some great man of faith coming to set things straight and bring back the worship of the one true God or any such thing like that. No, it's just going to happen through a guy who has all the same ambitions you have, and he's just going to cut your whole household down. And it's because this idolatry, this is sort of the result of it. What is now pervasive through the kingdom is sort of that anything goes. I mean, you have like a might makes right kind of thing here. This guy's going to take over, and he's got to make sure that all of your descendants are dead. Not because God said so, because that's what he needs to do to make sure that he can reign.
Yeah, this is one of the cases where God uses evil men,
yep,
who do evil things to accomplish his purpose. And we have multitude of examples of this throughout the scriptures. But you do have that tension between God saying, okay, this is what's going to happen. And when it happens, it's done in a sinful way by sinful people.
Yep.
But it's still it's God governing this history toward his desired end. So this happened in fulfillment of the prophecy. It was for the sins of Jeroboam that he sinned, that he made Israel to sin, because of the anger to which he provoked the Lord, the God of Israel. And then verse 31 wraps up Nadab. The rest of the acts of Nadab and all he did, are they not written in our favorite book, the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. So that really should be the end of chapter 15. This is one of these weird chapter divisions. This is actually the end of chapter 15, but it should be the beginning of chapter 16. This is one of those strange chapter division places, because we're going to be introduced to a new guy now. Verse 33. In the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ahijah, began to reign over all Israel at Tirzah, and he reigned 24 years. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and walked in the way of Jeroboam and in his sin, which he made Israel to sin. So this is like no change. In other words, it's a new guy. It's not the son of Jeroboam. It's a guy who actually took out the entire household of Jeroboam, killed his son, who was reigning in his place, killed all the males, made sure everybody's gone. And then as soon as he's king, he's like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do the same thing that Jeroboam did. So there's like no creativity here going on. We're just going to perpetuate this. We're not going to repackage the Jeroboam stuff. We're just going to keep on right on doing what we've been doing all along.
Yeah. And this, like, he sinned, and made Israel sin. Yeah, this is just the Bible's way of saying, kept worshiping them false gods, so all the people kept worshiping those false gods, and so the cycle continues.
Yeah, and if, as you're listening to this, you're thinking, man, this is just like kind of predictable. That is sort of the point.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. The predictability of the outcome of idolatry is one of the points of Kings. This is what's going to happen every single time. Every time somebody goes down the path of idolatry, it will lead to destruction. There are no surprises. There are no like forks in the road. It will always go the same direction, always go to the same end. The wages that sin pay is always the same. It never changes. It's always death. Yeah. The wages that idolatry pays are always the same. It's always death. And that doesn't mean that there's not a chance for repentance. It just means that unless you leave the road of idolatry, there's always and only one destination that this is taking you to.
Yeah, and what happens is Kings highlights the anytime there's a break in that cycle, like it did with Asa. Like you get this, it's not a long thing about him, but you get sort of a different, you get more attention paid because Asa was different than what was happening. And so you have idolatry, 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 breaking that, and then we will find like right back to it.
Yeah. Then it just shifts right back to it. But thankfully, I mean, it's like it's a respite on occasion. It's a little oasis, right, in this desert of idolatry that we have, where these people come along and actually do some good things and call Israel back to where they should be.
Well, it turns out that worshiping God is far more interesting than worshiping false gods. It's just so predictable and boring. But when you have somebody who breaks that cycle, that person is interesting. And I mean, and it seems like if you were reigning and you were looking back, you're like, okay, now where are the good spots? It's always there. And so it would seem like something just practically and pragmatically worth replicating, but very few do.
Very few do. Yeah. Yeah. So if you want to be like the most fascinating and interesting of characters, then you want to be like the saints, right? You want to be like these, the kings like David and Asa and Solomon in his earlier years. I mean, these are the wise and fascinating characters. Of course, not perfect, but they are extremely interesting people, creative people. And the reason is because they're followers of Yahweh. That's it.
Or you can look at the other people and be like, I mean, what would it be like to always be afraid that someone's going to cut me down and destroy my entire household and have God angry with me? And that seems way less appealing.
Yeah, yes.
But that's the insanity of sin. I mean, I know as a sinner, I know about the insanity of sin. Like, I mean, it's you do things that don't make sense.
Yeah, I mean that gets to the irrationality of human behavior, sinful human behavior, where we do things that we know and everybody knows will do us great harm in the end, and yet that is still what we are inclined to do. So chapter 16 begins with telling us more about what was going to happen to this new character, Baasha. The word of the Lord came to a guy by the name of, I never know how to say this in English. It's a lot easier if you say it with the Y of Hebrew, but Jehu, is it Jehu? How do we usually say his name? J-E-H-U.
It depends on who's reading it. I mean,
like... depends on who's reading it. I mean, there are times when it's like, it's just easier to say in the Hebrew. It's Jehu, but it's as with a lot of these names, the Y in Hebrew gets changed to the J in English. So Jehu or Jehu. Now this don't confuse this character with the king by that same name that we're going to encounter later. There's actually a number of individuals in the Old Testament with this name. This guy is a prophet, so don't confuse him with King Jehu later on. So God's word, the word of the Lord came to Jehu the son of Hanani against Baasha, saying, since I exalted you out of the dust and made you leader of my people Israel, and you have walked in the way of Jeroboam and have made my people Israel to sin, provoking me to anger with their sins, behold, I will utterly sweep away you, that is Baasha, and your house, and I'm going to make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. Anyone belonging to Baasha who dies in the city, the dogs shall eat. And anyone of his who dies in the field, the birds of the heavens shall eat. This is actually not almost, this is verbatim what was said about Jeroboam. And so we see basically that this guy who destroyed Jeroboam's house and then basically continued to do what Jeroboam was doing, he now is going to face the same fate as the very house that he destroyed. So just adding level upon level of the insanity and the irrationality that's taking place in the Northern Kingdom. And I wish that we could end on a more positive note, but we'll have to save the more positive stuff for the next episode because we're out of time.
Yeah, well, the positive notes are few and far between in this particular book, especially at this point in the book. We're not.
At this point, there's a lot more darkness than light.
It is. So it is darkest before the dawn, I suppose. So maybe we'll get there next week, but we'll have to leave it there for now. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right, see you then.